707.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 200 years ago, this was new music, and people filled the concert halls of Europe expecting to hear the latest from a shocking new composer, Beethoven. But in 21st century America, concert audiences rarely hear the music of their own times. Orchestras still program Beethoven more than any other composer. One reason is that many people think modern music sounds like this. But now some composers are giving serious music a new sound. Some are even going so far, Milton Babbitt, hold your ears, as to bring back melody, harmony. Connection listeners, are you afraid of modern classical music? Are you content to keep listening to Beethoven and Chopin? Or do you need to hear the music of our time? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us on the program today are musicians dedicated to modern classical music and to reuniting the concert-going public with the music of our times. I'm going to start with Gil Rose, who's in the studio with me. He's artistic director of the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
Can we hear just a bit more of Mr. Babbitt? Not exactly music I'm going to be whistling down the hallway when the program is over. Is that why people are afraid of modern music, Gil?
Because they can't whistle to it?
I don't know.
Well, you know, I was kind of struck by the examples we started with. In many ways, these pieces are quite different, but in many ways they're quite the same. They're both dealing with rhythm and melody and harmony and creating tension and letting go of tension. They just have a different vocabulary, which seems to be, one seems to be comfortable to us, well-known, and the other seems to be foreign and confusing to us.
So what would be in the introduction of The Idiot's Guide to this shift?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, where did we go away from da-da-da-da, something I can remember, to something that I can't? What turned?
Well, there are a lot of factors which have caused a kind of change, but we may do best to look at ourselves a little bit more. Arnold Schoenberg made a famous quote sometime in the 50s and said that by the turn of the century, all school children would be humming the tunes from his string quartets. They aren't humming the tunes from his string quartets, but they definitely still stay with us. They're important pieces of music that have added to the canon of our 20th century musical life, but they seem to not be as have the staying power that the forces of Beethoven and Brahms and Chopin and Verdi and others occupy in our public consciousness. Why that is a complicated question, but a lot of it has to do with the structures that were built up to support music making, the public music making. I'd say probably just after the Second World War, the structure of symphony orchestras and opera companies in this country grew and was established as larger and larger institutions. Their budgets got bigger and bigger, and they became more formal, played more concerts, more structurally solidified in the firmament of the musical life of any major American
city. But still playing the old stuff.
Well, not so much, actually. That's something that's kind of misunderstood, I think. We now live in a time where our larger performing institutions play mostly older music. We often say the music of dead white European men, when no dead white European men that I know are around, but they do perform mostly this music. That was not always the case. Even as recently as the 30s and 40s, large major symphony orchestras were performing considerably more new music and commissioning music. The Boston Symphony Orchestra, in fact, was famous under Serge Koussevitzky for bringing many, many pieces that we think of as standard repertory pieces into existence. There's been a shift from that position. In the larger sense, we also should acknowledge that in this time where we play mostly older music, music long since passed of another era, we are living in an historical anomaly. This is the only time in musical history from the beginning of Western music that we know of where we perform mostly the music that's gone past and faded into the, not faded into the distance, but is in the, was composed in the past and is not of today. So we kind of live in a strange blip in the graph of our musical history, in a sense.
Let's step from the music of dead white European men to a piece of music by a live white young American
man.
There
you go.
The piece of music we're listening to is the first movement of Concerto No. 2 for piano and orchestra. It was composed by Lowell Lieberman, who is joining us from our studios in New York. Hi, Lowell.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. There's a melody there. There's a bit of harmony there. What the heck are you up to?
Well, you know, there's a bit of everything there. There also does happen to be a quite rigidly intellectual structure going on. With all kinds of things in it that I dare say a lot of the critics who like to divide, you know, the music world into two different, and should I say they like to position them as opposing camps, often miss. You know, your question earlier about what has shifted, what has changed, I would actually say not that much, because I think there always has been difficult music, and there always has been accessible music, and also there's always been good difficult music and bad difficult music and good accessible music and bad accessible music.
This is getting very complicated. Gil Rose, does music need to be complicated to be good?
No, not at all. In fact, I think Lowell has just hit on a very important point, which there seems to be in the public mind a belief that if it's complicated and involves an intricate structure that can't be immediately perceived, then it must be serious. I know plenty of pieces of music that are complicated, involve a structure that can't be immediately perceived by the ear, and are no good. I know plenty of pieces that are simple, direct, melodic, tuneful, written within the last 5 years, which are wonderful. I know pieces of the same descriptions, but reversed, complicated music that is very good and simple music that is very bad.
But isn't it fair, Lowell, to make a division between music that appeals to the intellect and music that appeals to the heart, to the emotions?
Not necessarily, because I don't think the line is always that clear. And, I mean, one of the things in my own career that I find very frustrating is that I've been classified by certain people as a certain kind of composer. Either, you know, I've been called neo-romantic, which is a label I'm very uncomfortable with. I've been called a new tonalist, which I'm slightly less uncomfortable with, but still quite a bit uncomfortable, because my music is just as often atonal or non-tonal. And I think these categorizations can be very, very limiting.
What is it that stings about being called a neo-romantic? Why is that?
Well, if I had to classify myself, I would much more say that I was a in the neoclassicist vein rather than neo-romantic, because I'm very interested in structure. What bothers me about the neo-romantic is that I think when a lot of people hear that, they assume you're just kind of writing big sloppy melodies with little intellectual organization going on. And a lot of the critics I find, once they hear a tune, they refuse to listen deeper and see if there is something else going on.
Gil, when you are trying to make sense of modern music. And I know I'm going to trip over words at some point. When I talk about modern music, I'm excluding hip-hop and scratch. We're talking about modern serious music.
Can we use, for lack of a better term, let's use that.
I mean, people
Not
do.
That there isn't serious hip-hop and other musics also, but you know, that's a gets a little out of control, that conversation.
But it is a field where lines get drawn all the time. It is largely the critics who are drawing the line, who are trying to classify.
And why do they do that? Because drawing lines makes things tangible and marketable and sellable. Also, people in, you know, we've kind of given up our own critical thinking in a way. We have a lot of music available to us. It's coming at us from all different sources all the time, the radio, the CD, the DVD, online. We're just bombarded. And we love to put things in neat little packages. This person's a neo-romantic. This person is a serialist. This person is this. This person is that, which causes us to listen at the surface and not to listen deeper. You know, we played earlier there was the Beethoven and then you segue to a piece called Aria da Capo by Milton Babbitt. And it made me think that a little bit that Milton Babbitt is a perfect example of a completely misunderstood composer, I think. Milton Babbitt was a serialist who kind of went all the way with serialism, not just serializing pitches, but serializing rhythms and articulations and all aspects of music. But also for me, of that generation of composers, Milton Babbitt's music is some of the most ethereal and beautiful music I know of that time, too. And
I think that you've got a better set of ears.
Well, it's not a matter
people.
Of set of ears. I think it's a little bit how much do we go into a concert hall or put on a record and value a piece of music or rate a piece of music based on how much it comes up or doesn't come up to our expectations. If we sit down and expect that Rachmaninoff is the gold standard, then anything that doesn't sound like Rachmaninoff or sounds less like Rachmaninoff is a failure, and anything that sounds more like it is a success. So
okay.
It's a little bit about changing the public's expectations and getting them more involved, less involved with labels and pre-expectations, and more involved with just listening to the quality and finding a way to enhance their experience so that they can identify a quality musical experience, whether it be of any shading, flavor, or ilk.
Let's listen to Babbitt himself, 1958, the seminal article, entitled Who Cares If You Listen? Babbitt writes, I dare suggest that the composer would do himself and his music an immediate and eventual service by total, resolute, and voluntary withdrawal from this public world to one of private performance in electronic media, with its very real possibility of complete elimination of the public and social aspects of musical composition. Lowell Lieberman, you are definitely going in a different direction. You are composing music that you want to be heard, right?
Well, I mean, to me, music and all art is a form of communication. And if you're not communicating it to somebody, what's the purpose? I've often been asked, who am I writing for? What is my audience? And a lot of people assume that I'm writing music with the intent of being accessible. And this could not be further from the truth. The only way I know how to write music is to write music that I would want to listen to. And I have to say that that is constantly changing what I want to listen to, and I'm constantly doing different things and bringing in other elements. And again, you know, one gets classified. It so happens that the music of mine that gets played the most is the most accessible of those pieces. I certainly do have other pieces which could be considered more difficult or more craggy. But what I find with the press, and I do think the press is a problem, is that they don't have the technical equipment to listen to a piece of music and discuss it on its own terms. They have to deal in simplifications and generalities because they need a handle.
Connection listeners, do you need a handle when it comes to listening, to understanding, to appreciating and choosing the music that you want to listen to? 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this is the music of Lowell Lieberman, Concerto for Flute and Orchestra. And this hour, Connection listeners, a conversation about modern, serious music. This, as I mentioned, is Lowell Lieberman's work. He's with us on the, in a studio in New York City. Gil Rose is with me here in the studio. And let's hear a bit from Christos Kalendros. He's a composer born in Cyprus, came to Boston at the age of 19 to study composition at the Berklee College of Music. And he's on the phone with us. Hi, Christos.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good morning.
Now, join this little conversation we're having about where modern serious music is coming from. Some people will, and Lowell's been quite upfront about this, will criticize what Lowell's writing. He'll say, look, this is exactly where we should be going. What's your perspective?
My perspective is that today we live in a world of open-mindedness. There's so much new music happening in all styles. And a lot of it is being integrated into serious music. I find that young people are really, really accepting of an amalgam of music as being non-dissonant and, in fact, pleasing. Whenever I work with children, they easily accept dissonance as something that is just colorful.
So when you hear me talking about the fact that I can't whistle something or I can't hum it and that's why I'm inclined not to listen to it, what do you say?
I say that you have grown up using a specific musical language as your listening guide. So you're so used to it that it's impossible to like something that is completely foreign.
So you listen to something like a Lieberman composition, which is accessible to me, and you say that it's not the sort of work that you're doing?
It's not really the sort of work I'm doing, but it is very honest music, and even though it is accessible, it has a lot of complexity, it has form, it has all the beautiful things that composers like. So he has found the golden mean, where his music is accessible, but it has the complexity that academic people enjoy as well. And today it's difficult to find such a golden mean. All the 20th century has produced a vast array of tools. All the stuff that Schoenberg created and Babbitt and Bartok and Shostakovich, it's impossible to ignore. And all of us today as composers are trying to integrate this into our work without making the public go away, which is the most difficult thing because there is no training in the public.
Lowell Lieberman, when you sit and compose, do you draw on that same breadth of information that Christos is talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Again, I would say that my own style has changed and evolved. The bit of the flute concerto that you played was a period when I was kind of grappling with using tonality, not necessarily in a traditional sense, but using tonal materials and what the implications. And, you know, the latest pieces I've been working with deal much more with, you know, octatonic scales and atonality and other elements. So, you know, that's always changing. I don't necessarily mean that my style is changing, but your preoccupations as a composer shift just the way, I mean, the most famous example is you know, with Beethoven and what people claim are his three periods. Well, there are actually more like 15 periods in Beethoven, but, you know, you can see his musical thinking shift. But, you know, I think one important point to remember is that a single composer does not have to do everything. There are certain things that, you know, one composer just does well, where another composer may do another kind of music well. And the wonderful time that we're going through now and the richness of different kinds of musics that are accessible to us shows that there is room for all different kinds of music. And so this kind of divisiveness that is often projected onto the musical scene kind of disturbs me sometimes.
Does it still exist, you think?
I find very much so, especially in the press. And again, I think it has to do with the press trying to simplify things, trying to create. The press loves controversy. I mean, they love having a good story. So, you know, they love to kind of create this kind of tension so that there's something to write about.
But let's talk about the way that the music is written about, because when we're talking about writing about serious music, we're not talking about the front page of the Herald and a controversy there. We're talking about highly educated critics who, in
Are
my
they?
View, but, sometimes will write like, well, no, okay, we could argue with that, but we could, I mean...
But we are talking about a trend in journalism, which is also unique in the last 50 years. If you look back at New York Times articles or major papers, musical criticism sections, from the 1850s onward, you'll find the amount of press space given to any one article get smaller and smaller and smaller. We're having a crunch of, there has to be more ads for the department stores because of the economic realities of running a newspaper in this day and age. But if you look back even 100 years ago or more to look at, something as we think of the standard repertory piece of all time, the Dvorak Ninth Symphony, when premiered in New York in 1887, I'm not exactly sure the date, but late 1880s, 2.5 pages of press article before the piece was ever played.
But if you added up the amount of music journalism, including what was being said about rock and hip-hop, and do we have a balance there?
Well, I think that we probably, if you add them all together, we have more actual lines of newsprint than just with quote-unquote serious music. But the amount and length of an article or review, especially considering a new piece. You know, my orchestra performs music all composed in the last 50 years, and so consequently in our reviews often, as it should be, we get a fairly good description of the pieces. This piece was this, this piece mm-hmm. was that. In other institutions who are performing more standard repertoire, well, the verdict came in on the Brahms Third Symphony a long time ago. The reviewer doesn't really have to write that it was a good or a bad symphony. And in fact, it'd be pretty ridiculous for him to, you know, take exception with how the third movement was written or something to that effect. So consequently, what happens in newsprint is they have to focus on the performing artist, which has a lot to do with the kind of demise of the cultural environment acceptable to talking about and disseminating discussion about music and its place. We've replaced discussions about composers and what they're writing in the last 75 years with what singers are wearing and what they're what they're performing that day or what tantrum they had.
Well,
backstage.
Wait a second, but so does the promotion machine behind the industry. We're going to see Yo-Yo Ma there on the cover of the
absolutely
of the brochure, not Lieberman, not Calendros.
Right.
There's no room for creativity nowadays. Music doesn't seem to have an impact on people's lives, and especially in the 20th century and 21st century, even with music that's more accessible or whatever, it's impossible to impact the public in a very strong way. We've lost the mystical connection that we used to have with the public, and I don't think it's a matter of how complex or how accessible or how this or that our music is. It's another issue. I think that people don't want to connect with stressful things anymore. And the past century, and especially now, it continues to be very stressful, and we reflect it in our music.
Well, we're working on that mystical connection, and I thank you for being with us, Christos.
Thank you.
Christos Calendros, composer, on our conversation about modern serious music. And let's go to the calls, 1-800-423-8255, the lines, I should say. We're going to start in Wisconsin, and Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Hello, this is a question that's plagued me for a while in trying to listen to classical music. I find that the music out there it's a communication of art and of the souls of the people playing it, and I found that the people who are producing the music that goes for classical music nowadays, they're tortured, they're random. It's not art. It's an expression. It's an artful expression of a tortured and chaotic society, rather than the highly ordered society that produced the classical music of the past.
Are you saying which is as it should be, Mark, or no?
No, I think people don't listen to music to increase their stress levels. They listen to it to reduce them and to find a. if you're looking for a mystical connection, they're looking for something that will take them to something that's less stressful, more comfortable.
Go ahead, Gil.
Yeah, Mark, you've actually put your finger on it, and Christos just said something somewhat connected to that, that a lot of the public's seeming desire or appetite for a kind of music from a past time is a little bit connected with the fact that it would be impossible for any composer or any good composer writing music today to not be affected by the stress and the kind of world we live in. Composers write music reflective of their times. That's one of the things that makes their music live past. Beethoven's music is still with us today because it accurately and passionately interacted with the events of and the people and the social movements of the time. But a composer today cannot magically transport themselves back to the 1780s and write something in the style of Mozart. It would not only be impossible, be irresponsible and kind of unartistic. But it does have a lot to do with the fact people are burdened with a great many tensions and problematic. They see the news from around the world, and they think they have their entertainment time, and they want to have something that feels good and makes them remember and recollect a more comfortable time in the past. Well, they think it was a more comfortable time in the past. I have a theory that somehow music is more connected to the reminiscence part of the brain than visual art or dance or anything else, other artistic ventures, because people tend to react and judge music. The general public tends to react and judge music based on how it lines up against this kind of feeling that the older music, older symphonic music particularly, gives them. And I think that we can't kind of go back there because we're not really investing. What are people 2 years from now going to say when they have to go back 400 or 500 years to listen to music, as opposed to what we did in this time?
I want to hear from Lowell here, but first just a quick question to Mark. Do you want to hear the work of modern composers, Mark?
I like what I heard of Lowell's work. I thought it was accessible and it was appreciable. And when I listen to, when I think about what the classical composers were trying to do, they were trying to work for royalty. They were trying to, if the king yawned three times during the composition, you were out of there. It was a very, it had its own stresses. And I feel like the modern composers are the only stress that they have is, do people understand me, not am I pleasing someone greater than myself?
Lowell, let's hear from you.
Well, I'd like to address a couple of things that were said before, and I'm kind of agreeing and disagreeing at the same time, because Mark said that in Mozart's time it was a much more orderly society and everything, and composers didn't have the stresses. I don't agree with that. I think things probably seem just as chaotic, and actually also musically chaotic. If you pick any year in the past and see the amalgam of styles and composers working, it was probably just as bewildering. The other thing I wanted to address is what is personally for me the cliché of art having to reflect its times. To me, I don't really know what that means, listening to a Mozart string quartet, if that quartet really reflects its times, its emotional climate. And for me, the attraction to me for art has not been to reflect my times, but in a way to create a more perfect abstract world. And I think that one cannot help, as a composer, being of one's time, whether you're trying to reflect it or whether you're going against it. Even if you're going against it, it's a reaction to what's happening around you. And what I find very interesting is that, music history is there's a whole line of composers from, Bach to Brahms to Samuel Barber, Rachmaninoff being a prime example, who were denounced or derided in their days as being conservative. And yet, looking today back at some of these composers, now Rachmaninoff seems as much a product of his time as some of the more experimental composers, Bartok or Leo Ornstein or somebody who was working at the same time. So, I think it all comes out in the wash, but one needs the removal of time. One needs that objectivity to really evaluate things, which is, quite frankly, why I don't spend any of my personal time thinking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. I just write music. All I know how to do.
Isn't the best, the very best music, whatever it is, timeless in its own way?
It is.
One would hope.
It is timeless, and that's why it survives. But even what Lowell was just talking about, if you choose not to react to the current trends and put yourself in a position of being a composer, kind of going out of the trend of their times, you're still reacting to your times. You can't not react to your times, even if that is to suggest that, as some of the postmodern composers did in the 60s, that they were going to completely, eject and the serial or modernist tendencies of the recent past and go a completely different direction. They were creating you can't get out of the time warp, as it were. You're stuck reacting to your environment, and even if that reaction is to not react to it. So,
all right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call, and Connection listeners, do stick with us. We have more calls, more things to talk about as we explore modern music. We wanted to go into our next break, Gil, with a piece of music that you've brought, a Thomas Addis piece.
I did. Thomas Addis is a very composer getting a lot of attention in Europe now, a young English composer of the ripe age of 29 or 30. He's quite the composer du jour in Europe, and coming more and more into the North American scene, and worthwhilely so.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're back right after the break.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about serious music, new serious music, serious new music. With me on the program today, Lowell Lieberman. He is a composer who has written more than 80 pieces, including two symphonies, an opera, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and concertos for piano, flute, trumpet, and piccolo. And with me in the studio, Gil Rose. He founded the Boston Modern Orchestra Project in 1996. He is artistic director and conductor of BMOP, as it's known. And their season begins on January 28th at the New England Conservatory for people in the area. It's called Who's Afraid of Modern Music? Inventive. Yes, indeed. Inventive. Almost like one of the mothers of invention. Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa.
Not a name we associate with serious music?
Not us, but a lot of people do, actually. Frank himself saw himself, that's how he chose to, in his mind, identify himself as a serious composer. He wrote a lot of music for ensembles and symphonic music, film scores. He was even, at the time of his death, working on an opera for the Vienna State Opera called Uncle Sam. And one can only imagine what that would have been like had he been able to complete it. But Frank is a perfect example of one of the kinds of composers that are out there. There is, we live in an age, which has been mentioned before, of all sorts of styles. The Pandora's box on what new music can be has been opened, and everybody's out there writing everything from soup to nuts, influences from rock and roll, from jazz, from indigenous musics, through serial composers still out there strong. We have the full gamut of what's possible available to us. My orchestra in Boston does a series trying to present the whole thing from every shade and flavor possible.
But you're a bit of a teacher on this, and are you telling me, are you telling our listeners that in order to understand, better appreciate Frank Zappa and Lowell Lieberman, that you can't pick Lowell's music and say, that I like, that I'm going to listen to, that you're actually better off saying, what else is
well,
out
you
there?
Can, but you're selling yourself short. There's a wide variety of things available. I always try to make a concert and program a concert so somebody will come back to me afterwards and say, I liked that piece, I hated that piece, I never heard anything like that third thing. What was that about? I want to check some more of that out. And boy, that was just ridiculous, that fourth thing. You should never do anything like that. Because then I know one thing is happening. I know my audience is interacting with the concert experience, which is something we gave up on, actually. We kind of, in this last 30 years, have turned going to a concert into an equivalent of going for an ice cream sundae. I mean, if it's sweet and entertaining and it goes down well and we're not too, put off by anything, it was a success. Well, Beethoven wouldn't recognize that. He would be turning over in his grave if he knew what we had created. We should go to a concert looking to learn more, to experience more, to challenge ourselves and to be challenged and to be comforted at the same time. All these kinds of musics are out there, and if put together in creative mixes, I always try to do programs that have as many different style varieties as possible, but usually we mentioned a little earlier the idea of a handle. We did a concert in the fall, which was all based on Chinese music. It was composers who were writing music based on Chinese music. There were five different composers. They couldn't have been more different in their styles, but there was one unifying theme, which was their exploration of Chinese music.
And Lowell, what do you want people to say to you after a performance of one of your pieces?
Well, I'd like to feel that they were actively engaged. I think the important thing is that music listening should be a passive experience. It should be a very active experience. And I think that is a problem with audiences, that they go to a concert expecting to be kind of passively entertained rather than really paying attention. But I think it is a vicious cycle. I mean, there's a presumption of musical illiteracy in the press, which prevents the press from discussing anything at a very deep level. Even most orchestras will not allow musical examples in program notes, because it is assumed that the audience does not read music. And I mean, all of this, speaks to the state that our whole culture has gone in. And it's a very big question. It's one that institutions are grappling with. And how do we get the audience? How do we reach them?
And it's one that journalists are grappling with as well. We've got on the line with us from Wellesley, Massachusetts, David. And David, you write about music.
That's right. I'm a music journalist, and I've been the program annotator of the New York Philharmonic previously, and also the American Composers Orchestra, which is a new music orchestra in New York. And I want to say first that I think you're doing a great job of wrestling with this very vexing subject. And I had about 500 things to say about it. I'm just going to restrict myself to one anecdote.
All right.
A couple of years ago, I was in Santa Barbara, California, and I went to a chamber music concert, and the local retirement community bussed in an entire busload of elderly ladies to hear the chamber music concert. And it was a mixed program, as they often are. I believe there was some Beethoven and some Ravel on it. And there was also a work by the present-day American composer George Crumb. It was called Vox Belenii, and I'm sure your guests are familiar with it. It means Voices of the Whale. And the players wear masks, a pianist, a flutist, and a violinist. and they perform on a stage lit in blue light, and they make very strange sounds on their instruments. And I...
So what did the people think of it, David?
Well, I, of course, thought that, this would be the low point of their evening. And instead, at the intermission, they were all abuzz.
Sure.
And all these ladies in their 70s and their 80s were saying, wasn't that interesting? My goodness. And those sounds he made on that violin. And those masks, it was so mysterious. And they were very excited about it.
So what's your conclusion from that, David?
My conclusion, well... I got two conclusions. One is maybe when you get a little older, you realize that life is short and you better just open your mind to everything that's coming in because you really don't have much time to be closed-minded anymore. And the other conclusion was that people love something creative and new and exciting. And it may be that perhaps a performance of a Schoenberg string quartet, the usual scene of four people sitting around staring at music stands and performing may not get them going quite in the same way, but I think when people open their ears and they adopt an attitude of enjoying life and enjoying whatever's coming down the road, then you get a lot more out of it.
People can also, there's one truism about people which gives me great hope for the development of contemporary music in the world in this country, is people can smell quality. They may not be able to understand how it works, how it breaks down, but speaks to how composers communicate with people. Sometimes their musical language is more complex than we might think is directly communicative. But if they're very good and they know what they're doing, like George Crumb is a perfect example, it sells. People can really smell it. It's not something they can put their finger on and always describe, but quality does rise to the top. Whether the structures are there and the opportunities are there to this music to be brought forward at the level it should be in a healthy musical environment, that's a completely different question. But given the chance, people will understand quality.
David, thanks for your call. We're going to swing over to Louisville, Kentucky now. Patrick's joining us. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Great. Thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it. I was just calling because the show is very interesting, and congratulations to all of you for trying to make sense out of all of this. But I think as a 32-year-old in this day and age, I think something that everyone's missing here is that we feel as though the artists, whether they are theater writers, whether they are playwrights, whether they are musicians, whether they're composers, have forgotten how to tell a story. And you can make all the points that you want to within the story. That's why Mozart is so wonderful, is because he could make every single point that he wanted to make musically, but do it within the frame of a story. Therefore, it takes the listener along. You go with the story, you understand, and by the end of it, you've been both entertained and enlightened. And I just wonder if Lieberman would like to say something to that. Thanks.
Thanks for your call, Patrick. Lowell.
Sure, and I'd like to address that, but also tie in the George Crumb anecdote and some of the comments Gil made afterwards, which is, to me, George Crumb is a very accessible composer. He uses complex materials, but it's the way the materials are communicated and organized that makes a piece accessible. It's not the materials. One can write totally tonal music and make it very inaccessible, which is back to the whole point that it is about communication and how clearly the composer or the artist or the novelist is communicating his structures to his audience. And yes, for me, it is about not necessarily telling a story, but taking the listener a distance where you feel you have gone somewhere. I mean, to me, I appreciate, those pieces of music that bring me into a different landscape. And it can be an abstract landscape. It can be a more familiar landscape. But also, the music that I admire most is the music that can be appreciated on many different levels. Take a Beethoven string quartet, the most musically uneducated person could listen to a Beethoven string quartet and get something out of, you know, just the sheer sonic beauty of it. And yet there is much more for the musicologist to delve into. You know, but it's in those terms, it's that kind of accessibility that I think is important. And for me, a composer like George Crumb has that because it is very immediate. It does state its goals.
So Gil, what's the flashlight here? Because Babbitt talks about that music reaching the level of advanced math and advanced physics. And if you don't understand advanced math and advanced physics, you won't get advanced music and go somewhere else. But what you're saying is that there is a way in, even if something doesn't appear on the face of it appealing.
Right. Well, you can often have quite wonderful experiences with even complex music, just appreciating the kind of you know, I think of John Cage, who hasn't come up in our conversation,
right.
and that's at the end of the hour, so the name we shall not mention because it
but
would
it has
mean
come
another
up
hour.
Now.
But it has come up now. You know, this was also another movement in music which caused, and still to this day causes great conversations and controversy. But what I always found with Cage, who was the opposite of Babbitt in some ways similar, was the desire to, or the what I learned about listening to Cage was that you can listen to things and appreciate the beauty that they exist and the sound they make. And they don't require you to bring a prefigured idea of what will make them successful. Once applying that to other kinds of music, even though many of the structures and complexities I don't hear them. I would be lying to you to tell you that I delved immediately to the center of Milton Babbitt's music when the first time I heard it, or Elliot Carter's music. But there is a level of appreciating that kind of music without understanding the complexities. As far as a flashlight goes, I think that it's not so much a flashlight, but a will to turn the flashlight on. The public somehow needs to realize that there are great rewards and great experiences in delving into all the wonderful kinds of music that are out there being composed now.
Gil, thanks for being with us
today. My pleasure.
Gil Rose, Artistic Director of the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. Lowell Lieberman, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Lowell Lieberman, composer, joining us from New York Connection listeners. Special thanks today to our intern, Carter Holleran, for helping us pull this program today. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Schugertz. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. We'll leave you today with the final movement of Lowell Lieberman's Concerto No. 2 for piano and orchestra.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WB.